Accession number 20504, Reel 1.
Taffy Bonner, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in a little place called Turfill in South Wales on the 10th of May 1914.
Where is Turfill? Where is it near? Which big place is it near?
It's near Cardiff.
Did you grow up and have your schooling at Turfill?
Yes, I had my schooling at Turfill. And I left school when I was 15. And there was no work for us, only down the mines on the... And I didn't want to go down on the mines. I didn't want to go down there at all. But my father was a very, very strict man. And he told me that while I was under his roof, I would do as I was told. So I thought, well, I don't know what to do. So then I thought, well, I'll give it a try. And I went down for about 6 months. I was working on a 2-foot seam of coal, lying on my side, shoveling coal with the miner had drawn onto the conveyor belt, which was doing approximately 60 miles an hour, shoving the coal down to the middle of the pit. Well, I stuck that for so long, and then I said, well, this is not for me. So what I did in 1932, I went and joined up, and I joined up at Woolwich Barracks. I can't forget it. I know it is in 1932. And I went up to London. They sent me to London, to Woolwich Barracks. And from there, I went into a squad of about 22 soldiers, all young soldiers, and after I'd done my training, I was moved to Colchester into the 17th Field Regiment, which was all strong.
How did you get on with the training?
I got on very well with the training, as I was no... mother's boy or anything like that, and I got on well with the training, and I passed my first and second class of education. But if you didn't pass that, you were kicked out. So I went from there to Colchester, and I was in the 17th Field Brigade, and then I can't think of the year we moved from Colchester to Shrapnel Barracks at Woolwich, and the 3rd Field Brigade was there, and they were moving out to India, and we took their place at Shrapnel Barracks. I stayed in Shrapnel Barracks for about a year, and I volunteered for India. I went over to India on the Lancaster troop ship. It took us 14 days, and I landed at Bombay. And from there, we caught one of them trains that went up, right up towards the northwest frontier of India, which was a place called Nowshera. And that was the 4th Field Brigade there then. I joined the 4th Field Brigade, and I got handed 2 horses and 2 ton of harness. But we didn't clean the harness. We had little coolies to clean the harness. But we did everything else. We looked after the horses, and I think it was in just on 1933 that we got mechanized, and we took hold of all the old crops that was going until we started to get more vehicles and guns, and We were most of our time in Al Shira because that was right to the right on the Muslim of the Khyber Pass, and we used to go out when there was any trouble with the Indians. The Purpura Vipi was the big chief then in India, and he was causing all the trouble. Well, we used to go out for perhaps weeks or a month, and it wasn't very nice because all you saw was rocks, and the ground was very, very hard, and you had to, we were in tents. And what was a great laugh, at night we used to be in the tent, and it was a bell tent, and we used to put bets on and let to find out the first shot that was fired at our lamp would get it, whether they hit it with the first shot or the second shot. And being very good soldiers or tribesmen, they would get it nearly on the second shot. And then we used to share the money out. And then from there, I went to the motorbike section. And I was in the motorbike, a DR, for a long time. And that was very, very tough, because when you were going away somewhere, you used to have your revolver, and you had you were told to always keep one round for yourself, because if you got caught, I mean, you'd have better death killing yourself than being killed by the tribes people, because they used to take your eyes out, and you know, and they were very treacherous killers. But we got all through that.
Did any of the Donars get caught?
Oh yes, there was many of the Donar got caught, yes. And then I went down to the Attic Fort, and then of course in 1935 was the Quetta earthquake. And that's when the old king died. And we went from there, from Nowshera to Quetta, to do rescue parties. And it was, and the smell that was in, because bodies were buried for days in there. And we thought we were going to get a trip home, but now we had to go back to our regiment. And I stayed there till about 1938. And then I came home on the Dilwara trooper.
What was life like for a soldier in India in the 30s?
Very good. Very good. I mean, different to it today. There was a lot of, places you could go and see. And you didn't work all the time. I mean, we used to get reveille at 4 o'clock in the morning. We had to see to the horses and feed them and brush them down. And then we had our breakfast. And then we did nothing then from then till 8 o'clock at night, because the heat was so hot. You could bear to walk on the ground. Well, when I come home, I come home on the Dilwara.
Could I just ask you before you come home whether you were in any support of the civil power in India against any riots or anything like that?
Oh yes, we went out on riots, but that was nothing. I mean, it only lasted probably a couple of hours. And
where was that?
That was in Banu, and because we used to go for 6 months up to we went to a place called Barayan. That was up in the hills, because it was they used to take all the married families up there, because the heat on the plains was so bad, and that was to give you a break.
What were they rioting about in Banu?
Oh, something that was happening with their government, and they didn't agree with it. you know, they never agreed with it, and they used to start riots. And they've got soldiers in Indians, which they call the Pathans. Now, they go about and they carry a dagger in the back of their neck. And if they got that dagger in the back of the neck, they are hostile, you know. And, I mean, they can just bring it out and you don't know where you are. Now, I know of a time we was in the barrack room, and it's a hell of a long barrack room. And what they said was that you must keep your stuff underneath here. We used to call it sharpoy, which is your bed underneath, and we used to have lockers in there. And then we had, from there, we had our rifles was put through the loop of the rifles and then pinned on your arms, because they used to call them loose wallers. They would come along and no dog would touch them, because they used to rub this cheetah fat on them, on their skins, and no dog would attack them, only the Indian Afghan, the big Afghan with long ears and that. That's the only dog that would attack him. And they were very clever, because, well, we had a young trumpeter come from out from England, and the trumpeter always slept in the bed in the corner. On this Sunday morning, it was very, very, really hot, and we said to one another, well, old Budgie has not woken up. And we said, well, leave him. He hasn't got any calls to do. Well, the next thing was, we went over to his bed, and we found he was dead. He'd got a knife in his back. So what they do, being out there, you're buried straight away. I mean, no, they put you in an old orange box, like an old orange box it is, and you shoved, and they cement you in, because the tribesmen used to dig them up and see if there's any jewels or anything on them. And the life was, you had to take as it was coming. I mean, I did like India. I thought India was a very cultivated country. Not like you see here, where it plays it all open. Where they could dig, they dig, and they cultivated it, you know. And they were very clever on tailoring. You could go into a tailor's shop, and you could stand there, and they'd in 3 hours, they would have a suit all ready, boots and everything, brand new. Because so many of the families, as soon as the family got old enough, they had a needle in there, a needle and cotton, and that was their trade. And we went to Taj Mahal. We had a little trip to the Taj Mahal, and we thought that was very, very good. And then it seemed that India would be, I mean, home rule. So with all the talk was then, as soon as the British troops leave India, that's when the trouble will start. And that's how it's been ever since. Since we left there, they've got trouble all the time, because we used to stop that trouble. And
what was your standard of health like in India?
Very good. Very good.
You never fell sick?
No. I had a bit of sandfly fever, that was all. And that's like, it's something like malaria, but only a slight. Now, I used to go in the gyms every day, and we used to look after ourselves well. And the food was good. The food was really good for the soldiers. And I really enjoyed the time I was out there.
Which other places did you serve in apart from Nowshera and the frontier and Banu?
I didn't go nowhere. Only Nowshera, because we were troops then that only was mechanized. We were the only troops that was mechanized, and I didn't leave. I was at Nowshera. I used to go to the Peshaw sometimes for a course, you know, on gunnery course or that. But I'd been to Landy Cordell, but only on courses, that's all. And when I come home, it was very, very, we felt the cold because, it was like coming out of a boiling place into a cool place. And I got put to the 22nd Field Regiment at Shorncliffe.
What rank did you have by now?
I was a bombardier then.
What kind of equipment did 22nd Field Regiment have?
They had the 25-pounder gun and all the up-to-date other equipment and signalling and all that. And I shall never forget that when we were called all together on the 3rd, the September the 3rd, and everybody had to parade in the nappy because the Chamberlain was going to give his final word. Well, then he gave his word that we were at war with Germany, and I don't know why, but everybody threw their caps up, and I thought, well, you don't realise what you're going to go into, you know, because I think some of them thought, I'd had under fire in Nowshera and on the frontier, so I knew what to expect. Well, then, after the meeting, everything was all packed up, all ready to move. And when he said we was at war with Germany, they moved all of us, the guns, the number ones on the guns, and the drivers. They moved them out, and they said they were going on a night drive to get used to the night driving with no lights. Well, when we got to where we found ourselves was in Avonmouth. They drove us straight into the docks. All the dockers were all waiting to load all the stuff. They loaded all the equipment, and nobody was to leave their guns or nothing. But there was no gunners on the gunners were still at Shorncliffe. But we were going to take the guns over, and we would meet them over in where we landed at St. Azair's. So when after that, we got all the guns was all loaded, and they pulled out into the channel, and we stopped there 2 days, and we waited there for the convoy to come down from Scotland, and then they picked us up. At Avonmouth, and then the next thing we didn't know where we were going, but we found out that we landed in St. Azair's. That is the place where we landed. Well, to us it didn't look like that there was a war on, because all the places were lit up, you know. And so the next move we said we were going to get was to Roubaix, up on the Belgian frontier. Excuse me. Well, we got to Roubaix, and we was in a big place called the Frenois, which was a dance hall, cinema, and everything you could agree with. And we slept on the landings for about the end of, what was it, in January, the end of January, I think it was till the 10th of May. And that's when he started the attack on Belgium.
Just before we go on to that,
yeah.
How had you got on with the French population during that winter?
Oh, very good. Yeah. I mean, they did look after us, fair play. I mean, there was some hostile, you know, but, I mean, not everyone. And it was a winter, because we couldn't move any of the vehicles and all the... Because Jerry was the same, I mean, he couldn't do nothing. And they put us all on ammunition fatigues. You know, load up ammunition. And then on the 10th of May, we got orders for moving. And we moved over the Albert Canal into Louvain. And we fired about, it must have been 1,000 rounds, I should think, or with all the guns. And next thing we were told that we might have to make a move, Well, then the next thing was that we got up one morning and we saw a barrage balloon, and you could see the Germans in the basket. Well, what they were doing, they were arranging, giving all their gun arrangements where we were. Well, the next thing that came through was that Churchill was evacuating the BEF, and we'd got so much front to get to, which was Dunkirk. But we had nothing told us what was going to happen and all that. So we had to blow all the guns up and smash all the rifles and everything up. And they give us a map reference. And we were told that we had to make to this, docks, and the boats would be all there ready, waiting for us. Now, when we started on the road, we had we hadn't eaten it for nothing. And I remember we stayed in we came across a farmhouse that was empty, and they must have just left it. And it had been a young couple that we think that must have been living in there. And there was plenty of food in there, but we didn't know whether to eat it or not, because we were told that Germans, they're, what they call them, especially the, what they call them?
Fifth column?
No, fifth column. It had... they'd poison him or that, you know. So, but we took a chance and we were all right. And we were dead tired. So what we did, we got all the bedding and all that down into a cellar. And, of course, one of our blokes, he didn't think at the time, but he lit a fire. And, of course, they ranged on us. And, of course, when we got up in the morning... We tried to lift the doings up, but we could hardly move. It was all, the farm was all locked down. So we met a couple of other fellows there. They were infantry, and they got lost, and they asked if they could come in with us. And we said, of course. Well, then when we got nearly into Dunkirk, we got run in with all the refugees. And they were scrambling, and of course, he machine guns them there from the air. And it was a terrible sight to see women and children and old people being slaughtered like animals. And you could hear children crying for their mothers and all that, but we couldn't do nothing about it at all. So what we did, we cut across a field, and we come across some red caps, military priests. And they, what they did, they said, right, keep on this road, no cigarettes or anything to be smoked, keep on this road, and you'll come across another lot of more police red caps. So that's what we did. And then they told us, right, get all in. And they told us there and then that we would be picked up. But when we got onto the beach, we saw all these people, all these other soldiers, and some of them was running here and running there, and the ships was outside. Well, we thought, well, are we going to get them? We thought we would go to the docks, but they only in the docks was only two hospital ships. So being, there was nothing wrong with any of us, and they put us on driving the ambulances down to the docks. So what we did, in the ambulance I was with, there was about 12 blokes, and one was an RSM. And we, where the gangplank is onto the ship, we got halfway up, and we had this RSM, and he wasn't half a bloody weight, and we got up, and there was about 50 Dornier planes, jerry planes, circling around, and we knew they were kind of going for this ship. So we ran off the ship, and the old RSM ran on the ship. Well, he put two right down the funnels, two of the two ships, hospital ships, blew them to hell, and all we could hear was the screaming of the nurses and the doctors and the wounded soldiers, and that did knock the guts out of us. And we went back to the place there, and then they stopped moving any more wounded. And it was, I mean, you had to make your own life. I mean, I had one thing that had happened to me, which I remembered it for years. I was coming along with a few of our mates, and we heard this shell going off, and I ran, and I jumped into this hole, and my hand went right through a bloke's stomach. And I just said, sorry, mate. But when I looked and I seen Rosie, I got out of there, and I run like hell. And I was like that. And the medics caught hold of me, and they give me an injection. And I was all right.
To calm you down?
Pardon?
To calm you down?
Yeah, yeah. And
so this was a corpse, was it?
Yes, yes. He'd been right through the stomach. And he was only a young fellow and all. And then we stayed, I was on there four days I was on there. Well, there was nothing you could do. You could only just chat to one another, or because every now and then you had to take cover. Well, then I went into the water, and
was this on the beach or on the mole?
This was on the beach, this was. Well, then they said that go down to the water, there is some boats coming in. Well, then we were ordered then to go on the mole, because there were a destroyer coming in, and go and get onto the mole. Well, the destroyer got loaded, and the destroyer was no word of lie, it was like that. And the skipper was shouting to get off, we'll be back for you. But you know, when you're fighting for your life, they wouldn't get off. Well, then, next thing, it had a direct hit, and they were all killed. And that's when he fired another one, and he blew them all right in half. So we got this plank across, and we had to walk across it. And I was lucky. I got on a boat there, and it got sunk in the about half a mile out. But there was an old lady with a barge, her and her husband, and she picked about 100 of us up out of the water. And so we thought, we were looking around for anything, and we thought, well, there's no guns or nothing on here. And she'd only got a Brent gun. She had a Brent gun, the old lady, and she used to smoke a clay pipe. She worked on the Thames for years, her and her husband. And then We was in this ship. Well, we were halfway across when we looked up and we saw this Jerry plane, and he must have been observing us, because next thing he came right over the ship, but he didn't fire.